Welcome to our podcast, Is This Dementia?, where we talk about all things dementia, diagnosis, management and care. My name is Dash.
And my name is Sarah, and we are public health researchers.
Today, we are very thankful and pleased to have Professor Dimity Pond. So Dimity is a general practitioner and has honorary professor positions at Newcastle University, University of New England and the University of Tasmania with the Wiking Dementia Research and Teaching Centre. Dimity has a passion and interest in dementia and aged care, and so we're very excited to talk to you today. Welcome, Dimity.
Welcome.
Thank you, Dash and Sarah.
So, Dimity, the first question we ask each of our guests is, what does dementia mean to you?
I'll tell you a little story about how I got into this. It starts quite a long time ago when I got a job working for the College of GPs on a sleep research project. And it was for looking at sleep in older people. And amongst the questions that I had to ask these older people were questions related to whether they had depression, and also some tests of their mental ability, what we call cognitive function tests. In case that might affect their sleep, you see. I ended up interviewing about 150 people. Wow. And it was a great experience. I was quite young and I had a baby, and it was very convenient to be able to schedule this work in amongst the baby. Sometimes she came with me, and the older people really loved that. And also she got to know where all the biscuit tins were in the residential facilities. The nurses quite liked it too. So it was a very convenient, sort of flexible hours job that I did in those days. And as I interviewed people, I mean, probably the main thing that stands out for me is how resilient people are. And some of these people had lived through very harsh times through the Depression and so on. Remembered eating grass soup, which was all the food that they had, and so on. So that was amazing through the war and so on. But the other thing that I could see was that there was quite a lot of people scoring in the dementia range on the cognitive function test, and also depression scoring in the depression range. And, you know, they were all living in a big retirement village setup. And I thought, you know, I don't think that we recognize this enough in general practice. I was working part-time in general practice at the same time. So that's what got me interested in dementia. And then that took several years to get through all those people. And during that time, my own mother started to show some signs of forgetfulness and so on. And I became quite aware that this might be the beginning of dementia too, although I didn't have a clue what to do about it then.
So you were doing that research project while working part-time as a GP. When did it become a little bit more official, kind of your work in this area then of dementia?
The people I was working for who were at the University of New South Wales got another grant to look at educating GPs about dementia. And because I'd been the research assistant, they wanted me to go and talk to the GPs as well. And so I had to do training on what do you do if someone has dementia. First, how do you identify it? And then what can we do about it, if anything? And so that was really fascinating. And going and visiting the GPs, they were the same GPs. They were the GPs of the people I'd interviewed
before. Oh, wow.
So we'd established good relationships with that retirement village community. So we were working with them. And then later on, there was yet another grant, which I was one of the investigators for, which actually implemented some activities in the community to try and improve things and make life more fun and interesting for people. So it was a series of projects around that issue. Yeah.
So then, Dimity, where are we today in terms of, I guess, the opportunities and the roles that GPs play in the diagnosis and management of dementia?
All right. Well, first of all, I'd say that GPs have become a lot more aware of dementia, as we all have as a society. And of course, with our aging population, so that was like 30 years ago, and our aging population, there's just a lot more people with dementia because there are a lot more older people living in the community. And it is, by and large, not exclusively, but by and large, a condition that affects older people. So we are more aware of it, and GPs have some pathways now to diagnosis. There's more memory clinics set up. GPs have some ideas about how to start the process of identifying dementia, whether or not they're willing or able to make that diagnosis themselves, or whether they want to refer on to confirm it. But I'd say that where we are now is that we don't have a clear idea of how to treat it in the community. Well, we may have some ideas, but we don't have an organized system. So it's health services aren't quite there yet with providing the services and the support that people ideally would have.
That's such a good point, Dimity. And so leading on from that, our podcast is called Is This Dementia? So how do you answer that from your clinical role?
Okay, so that's a very interesting question. And sometimes, but not always, people come and say, I've got memory problems and I'm worried that it might be dementia. What do you think? But many times I'm looking at a person who has maybe started to forget their medications, or forgotten what I told them to do last time. And I think, oh, sometimes I forget stuff. Is it really a condition, dementia, or is it just a normal phase because they've got a lot going on? And so often as GPs, we sit with that lack of certainty for some time. I've learned a few things about that phase of identification. One is that obviously, you can do a cognitive function test, some questions. Some of the audience will have been asked these questions. And I'm sure some of the audience have practiced answers to their questions. And some may have then been asked different questions, which is annoying. They're not the ones they practiced. But so there's questions. And then the questions are the screening question. They're called screening questions in general practice. And it's not an exact science that it doesn't give you a diagnosis. It gives you a bit of a probability, but you can get 30 out of 30. I have people who get 30 out of 30 and they have a diagnosis of dementia.
Oh, interesting.
So because they were always very high functioning, school teachers or something like that, and they're used to remembering a lot, directors of nursing and so on.
Yes.
And they're used to being in charge of things and being able to organize things. And yet they're not functioning as well as they used to when they were younger. And so what we then look for is whether that score, we might need to repeat it 6 months or 12 months and just look at whether it goes down 30 one year and then the next year it's maybe 28, which is still a good score and it's still very much a pass. But and then the next year it's maybe 26. Still okay, but you're looking at someone who's losing a few marks each year and maybe just not on top of things the way they were. But then the question is that dementia or is that something else? Right?
Yes.
So it could be that they've been sick, There's been a lot of sickness around this winter, and I wouldn't be questioning anyone who's just been through influenza or COVID or RSV or any of those things, because your brain fogs up, doesn't it? And
Yeah.
it can take a few weeks to get over. So that is not a good time. So to do a dementia score. But perhaps your listeners are listening in summer and they don't have that problem. But if they've had any sort of illness, it's not a good time to be asked. And that's a little bit why the diagnosis is often not made in on a hospital admission, because people can have a test and they may not do very well, but that's because they're in hospital having had an operation and blood transfusion and on medications, and all those things can be very confusing. So the best time to do a test is in the morning when you're wide awake, during a peaceful time when you haven't had an argument with your daughter or something, and you haven't had sleeping tablets the night before that are still bombing you out,
Yes.
and you're feeling well and relatively at peace with the world. So, because another thing that will stop you answering those questions accurately is if you're feeling depressed or anxious or angry or something like that. So your emotions get, like with anyone, your emotions get in the way of answering the question because you're not really concentrating. You're thinking about,
Yeah.
why did they say that? Or am I going to pass this? Which might occupy more of
Yes.
your mind than the actual question.
Yes.
As a GP, if we're doing those questionnaires, we need to think about all these possibilities. And then the GPs and the practice nurses, who very much are the ones who do those questionnaires, are very good at putting the practice nurses are very good at putting people at ease. The GP practice nurses are sort of approachable, and my practice nurse can always get someone's blood pressure to come down by having a little chat for a few minutes.
Yeah.
And I've found that their blood pressure is high, and she goes, "No, doctor, that was you. You're fine now." And the same applies to the cognitive function tests. I think all of us can feel a bit anxious when we're confronted with a person in authority, you know, who's going to make some sort of decision about us. So depression and medications is another thing. Being on
Yes.
painkillers can make your brain fog up and you can't think of the answers. And it might all go away when you stop those medications. And I've actually had people improve very markedly when we've stopped some of their medications. It's not just painkillers, it's some of the other medications too. So if any of your listeners do a test and don't score as well as they would have liked, have a talk to their doctor about, am I on a medication that might be fogging my brain?
Yeah.
And especially as you're older, your brain tend you might have been on some sleepers or something for 20 years and coped well, but when you're in your 80s or something, your brain really responds very negatively to those same tablets. So we need to think about that.
That's such an interesting insight because I think that is something I've heard a lot about sleeping tablets, and people go, "Oh, but I've been on this forever." So the fact that your brain does change in terms of its response, wow.
And so it's actually really good to try and clear yourself of as many tablets as possible as you get older. And most people accumulate more tablets as they get older. It's good to. So I do have some of my older patients who've got this message because I've been telling them, and they sit down and say, "Do I really need all these?" And so we go through it. And sometimes we can say, "Well, maybe not, you know." Or maybe there's an alternative. Or sometimes tablets can be combined so that you're on one instead of two or something like that. Or sometimes it might be that if it's a pain medication, some exercise and some physiotherapy and some social activities, getting your mind off it, all of those, talking to the psychologist, all of those things can help and you don't need as much. You might still need it sometimes, but not always. So it's good to get healthier as you get older.
Mentioning all these things, Dimity, it's striking me how complex that process is of all of the things that you're taking into account and what you know about the person and how they're feeling and what's happening in their life that's sort of taking in playing out in that process as well.
Yes, yeah, so that's true, Sarah. And I think that's where having a primary care provider that you get to know is really good. Could be the practice nurse, or it could be the GP, or both, you know. Or sometimes it's the physio or someone that suggests to the person that maybe their memory isn't as good, go and see the GP.
Yes.
And they've got a real bond with the physio who they've been seeing regularly for a long time. So I think all sorts of primary care providers, even the optometrist picked dementia in one of my patients from looking at the eyes.
Yeah,
he
right.
found that there was part of the vision that was affected, and it was a brain effect, not the eye itself. And that diagnosis came through there. So it's a real team effort.
Yes.
But I do think that longitudinal relationship helps. And
yes.
in the literature, when we talk to GPs and patients as well, it's a bit of a journey of discovery, and the person has to come to terms with it. You know, you can't just say, well, at least I don't tend to just say, well, I think you might have dementia because you've gotten your appointment yesterday. You can't just do that. It takes quite a lot of working out and thinking
Yes.
about it. And people don't always want to go down that route. They might take a little bit of, you know, persuading that it's better to know because we can do some things and we can put in services to help. So it might not be a curable disease, but it's something that we can help you with if we know you've got it. So,
yes.
yeah.
And do you find that some of the patients that you see maybe are not wanting to have those screening tests?
Yeah, that's true, very much. And there may be reasons for that associated with they're worried that their family will put them in residential aged care, which has got a bad name since the pandemic, or they're worried that I'll take their driver's license away. And I mean, that is a concern, because if you've got dementia, you may be able to drive with a little bit of early dementia, but you will have to stop eventually. So people know that, and they think, how am I going to cope? I'm the driver in the family, you know. And in that case, if someone's actually showing a bit of impairment, I say, let's think about what you can do. If you do have to stop driving, did you know about the community transport that's available? It's quite good. You can get it through My Age Care. Are you registered with My Age Care? Why don't we get started on these things? I know we haven't got a diagnosis of dementia yet, but let's get things in place so that if that happens, then you'll be quite comfortably able to transition over to not driving. It does take time to work through the system to get registered and get assessed and so on. So it's quite good to get that going early on, and that's something we can do in primary care. And I may refer the person to the nurse to get that all going. She's very good at doing those things.
That's such an amazing point, Dimity, about all of these things that sort of sit around the person and the supports that maybe we can be doing, even if there isn't a diagnosis at that point.
Yes. And because it takes so long to get that diagnosis, it's good to get your head around. I've had one person who took about 3 years. She gradually slipped down. She used to go to the memory clinic, and she'd have a diagnosis of a thing called mild cognitive impairment.
Yes.
Some of the listeners will have heard of that. And that is a thing, and it may or may not go on to dementia. And in her case, she was showing some signs of it progressing. But she'd say to me, well, I went to the clinic and they said I haven't got dementia yet. And you know what I said to her, because this is very important, I think, for listeners. I said to her, I remember that appointment very well because she was so funny. I said to her, even when you do cross the line into dementia, you're still a person.
Yeah.
You still have choices. You are not going to lose your whole personhood because you've got this diagnosis. because people see it as robbing them of their self-esteem and their ability to make choices. And I suppose we often think of the worst case scenario of someone with very advanced dementia. But with early dementia, you still have all your choices, and most of them, maybe the more complex financial ones need to be delegated, and the driving will need to be delegated eventually. But your other choices in life, what are you going to do with your day? You're going to sit in the sun, or you're going to go for a walk? These things, you have options. What are you going to wear? You have options about that.
So, how did she respond, Dimity, when you said that to her? Was that a relief?
Yeah, I could see her shoulders going down.
Yeah.
Relief. I don't think she'd actually thought about it that way before, but I think she was anticipating a sudden gap where then she'd fall into a hole and not be able to do anything anymore. And wow. She was still bossing around her daughter, even after the diagnosis.
Yes.
It was all right. The daughter would sit behind her and shake her head and cross her arms and just go and roll her eyes. So it was good. That was all right. She was a good daughter. They got on well. Yeah.
Yeah. And that sort of takes me back to where you're talking about that system of supports and that broader healthcare system, that if you do have a diagnosis, it doesn't have to be a really big change initially. There might be some smaller changes. And
that's
true. I love that, thinking about all those different things, that supports you can put in place to continue to do the things you want to do.
And it's good to think through how that would work and what the person wants themselves.
Yes.
Because some people would like to do it one way and some people would like to do it another way. So I had one person recently who got registered with My Aged Care, and I said, oh, that's really good, you'll be able to get help with the cooking. And she said, I'm fine with the cooking. I went, oh, okay. Well, they're helping with cleaning. No, they're not helping with cleaning. I'm quite capable of cleaning, doctor. I said, oh, okay. So have they been? Oh, yes. They've come and they've cleaned the upstairs windows, which were too high for my husband and I to reach. And they've done a fantastic job, and we can look out on the bush now through those windows. And yeah, I said, and will they come back? Well, yeah, oh, there's a bit of work around the garden that's too much for us. So they'll, you know, she's just settling in with what she needed.
Yeah, that's great.
But can I tell you something else about this early time? And that's about a thing called secondary prevention, which listeners probably may not have heard of. And people have told me there's no such thing. But there is such a thing. I know that public health doctors know about secondary prevention.
Yes.
So we do know in diet and exercise and keeping active and keeping social, and keeping your mind active, these things are helpful to prevent or slow down the onset of dementia. Well, they're also helpful after a diagnosis in order to slow down the progression so that it doesn't get worse too quickly. So I remember my aunt had a stroke, and she was told, that this was many years ago, and she was told, well, she wouldn't have very long to live and she'd probably, you know, not be able to think clearly anymore. And that was the worst thing she could have been told, because she just sat around, let her sister, in those days, the younger sister used to always get the job of looking after the older ones and look after her. And she lived for about another 20 years, but she lost her ability to walk properly, and she lost all her joy in life. And I think it's really, really important to keep social, keep active, keep going for walks. There's walking groups you can go with, or you can, if you've got a friend, go with your friend. Your friend can help you out if you've forgotten someone's name that you meet along the way. So it's good to go with a friend. think about a good diet, and there's plenty of recommendations about good diets for dementia. But lots of fruit and vegetables, fresh fruit and vegetables, fish, the other Mediterranean, or there's one called the DASH diet, and and enjoy them. And you can get them made up if you like. There are various groups around the place that run some education for people, just to keep up with local affairs and stuff like that. And that's something you can do too. So you need to have a regular social activity. And if you're a bloke, go to the men's shed,
Yes.
and just keep active. And it doesn't matter if you're not producing at the level that you might have in the past, but it's the fact of getting out and talking to other people and doing something and achieving something makes you feel better.
Yeah, I really, really love that because, yes, as public health researchers, we were trained in primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. I do think that's been the missing gap in some of the narrative around dementia and just kind of thinking, oh, well, there's nothing you can do. And I guess one of the things that we've been hearing, and I've been hearing in some of my other research projects, is that whole thing of staying well and mobile and maintaining function and having a strengths-based kind of approach to that. Do as much as you can while you can and then get help for the things that you can't do, but keep doing alongside. Like, I just think has been such a powerful message. So thanks so much for highlighting all of that. But there was just one thing I wanted to also come back to in your practice, because it sounds like you do see people for a long time, but also what do you do when family members raise concerns about dementia?
So the family member raising that as an issue, I'm very happy to listen to family members. I wouldn't necessarily tell the person who may have the problem that their family member has dobbed them into me, but I would take steps to try and talk to them about how things are going, and mentally as well as other ways, and without mentioning the family member. I think that we greatly underestimate the effect of dementia on the family. And the reason I think that is that years ago, in one of the studies we did, we recruited about 160 people with dementia, and we interviewed 80 family members. And so that was about half of the people with dementia. We interviewed their family members as well. And we just asked them how things were going. And the stories were quite dramatic about what a heavy load those family members had. Even before the diagnosis, in some cases, they had been having to do a lot of support in terms of everyday activities, helping the person dress, shower, and so on, and dealing with maybe, them getting lost down the street or in the shopping centre. Actually, I get lost in the shopping centre, a big one, but we won't talk about that. It's a worry being a dementia researcher, I can tell you. You think about it all the time. Wandering off, maybe down the street and needing to be found. The family members find these kinds of stresses really, really difficult. And, eventually they worry about leaving the person by themselves because they might put an egg on the stove without any water in it, that sort of thing. And so eventually that really curtails their own social activities. And, I don't like to dismiss family members if they're telling me there's a problem. I'm thinking that this person may well be burdened with some support roles that are quite onerous. And family members can get quite a lot of depression and anxiety. I'm not saying that looking after a person with dementia, that your family member doesn't have its upsides, because of course you love them and you want to care for them, but it is hard work. It's a heavy burden. So I think we need to support them and take them seriously if they say there's a problem. That's where putting in supports even before a diagnosis is made may come in useful.
So true.
Yeah.
And Dimity, what does that sort of look like if a family member's coming to you? Is that, do they, does a family member come to an appointment, or maybe are they contacting you at other times, or?
There's a few different scenarios. First of all, there's not supposed to be a charge under Medicare if someone comes to talk to me just about someone else. So that's a bit tricky. But in actual fact, that rarely happens. Usually it's because the family members come to see me about themselves and I ask them how it's going. And then they go, oh man, that's so hard. It's this and it's that. And we have a chat about what might be put in place. And sometimes that family, the person living with dementia is not my patient. Then we might agree to have a chat with that person and that person's doctor and see if some more support can be put in place to help my patient who's the family member. So that's one scenario. But another scenario is to have the family member come in with the person living with dementia and we have a little bit of a chat. And then it might be that I get a chance to talk to them privately if the person needs to go out for some reason, or on the way out, we just wander along behind. If there's a number of family members, they can take one member off into the waiting room, and I'll just slowly walk down the corridor, having a bit of chat about how things are going. Home visits are really good. The nurse tells me that she takes a turn around the garden with the family member. She can get a lot of information that isn't confronting to the
Yes.
person living with dementia because nobody wants to hear their family member saying, I have to do this and I have to do that because she can't do these things anymore. That's very confronting.
Yes. And imagine, like, as you were saying before, some of that happens over multiple conversations.
Yeah. And actually, as time goes by, I actually encourage the person to bring their family member with them because at a certain stage with dementia, you lose the capacity to really reflect clearly on how well you're going because your memory's not as good as it was. And you might be thinking back to a few weeks ago, a few months ago, rather than what happened yesterday, which wasn't so good. And so having the actual family member there to just say, to have that opportunity to have a bit of a discussion, some with the person and some maybe separately, as I described, that's really useful. And I really like to see the family member. And there's things like taking medications that we doctors have to worry about. And I say,
Yeah.
these blood tests, this diabetes isn't doing so well, is she? Are you taking your medications? And the person living with dementia will say, of course I am. I take them every day. And the family member's going like this. And I say, how about we get the chemist to pack them up into a pack so that you get them all pre-packaged and we can see which ones you haven't taken. And I can also visit the chemist who's next door and she will show me a week's pack that's been returned with multiple ones that haven't been taken in
Oh,
it, so I can get
interesting.
a good idea of what's going on. And then we can look at streamlining those medications, as I mentioned before, so that it's not so much and it's maybe not as often during the day and so on. Yeah.
I turned 40 last year, and all of my friends turned 40. We've had a whole host of 40th,
Congratulations.
and all of us, because one of our friends is a GP, said we should get a 40-year check by our GP, like get
Yeah.
all of these
Oh,
checks
yeah.
run. And I'm very conscious that there are other ages where checks, like health checks, comprehensive
Yes.
health checks are run. At what point do GPs start to add cognition screens into those health checks?
Yes. Okay. First of all, I really support the health checks.
Yeah.
And statistically, we GPs don't do the ones for people in their 40s as often as we do the others.
Yeah.
And well, everyone knows there's a bit of a shortage of GPs, and people in their 40s aren't usually particularly unwell. But it is a wonderful time to catch early diabetes bit too much alcohol, bit of overweight, bit not enough exercise because everyone's busy, all of that, and start putting in some preventive activities, which are primary prevention, actually. So that, and a bit of high blood pressure and so on, so it can all be addressed then. So I think it is really good to do those. But so there's a couple in the 40s. If you've got, you can have a pre-diabetes check in your 40s, but there's also a health assessment in your 40s. And they finish at 49. So if, make sure you get it, listeners, if you've got that opportunity. But the next one starts at 75. I think there should be a lot more in between.
That's a bit of a gap.
It's a huge gap. Yes, unless there's certain particular conditions where you can get more regular checks, but intellectual disability and so on. But so 75. So 75 is when we GPs start doing cognitive function tests. Now, I will say to you, as a GP researcher, I know full well that the guidelines worldwide say that we should not screen just everyone for dementia.
Why not?
Because those questions that I mentioned earlier, which everyone practices, they in some cases people fail at, or fall into the dementia range because they can't hear what they've been asked. Like there's one question that says no ifs, ands, or buts. And some listeners will not have heard the S's at the end of those words as I've spoken. And the person actually technically fails that if they haven't heard the S's and they lose a point. That's
Interesting.
not dementia. That's
No.
hearing. That's just the normal losing high frequency sound as you get older. So there's reasons like that. Or it could be the bad day, the fight with the daughter, a bit of depression, not very well. Come in actually for a urinary tract infection and got a cognitive function test at that time, which is not a good idea. All those things. And what happens then if someone actually falls into the dementia range? They need the full workup, and that is bloods, a CT scan, and a medication review, and then maybe a specialist assessment. And by then, they and the family are resigned to the fact that they've got a terrible disease, but in fact they haven't. They just couldn't hear those S's and a few other things that day. They weren't well. So the thing called the positive predictive value is not very good at the best of times with dementia, but unless there's some good reason as well as the age for doing that check, then we're not supposed to do those cognitive tests. The good reason might be that they've got a condition which predisposes to dementia, such as they may have had high blood pressure, or they may have had diabetes, or they may have been a smoker. And those things we know predispose people to dementia. And then it's worth doing those screening tests as well at that age. Or they may have memory complaints. If they're complaining about a bad memory, of course we'll test their memory.
And they don't have to wait till 75 for that. That can happen at any
No, we could
point.
do it any time. That's absolutely true. But if we ask them, have you got memory complaints, and they're 75, then we would do the cognitive function test. Because the net result is that if we just do everyone, 50% of them will be false positives, 50% of the people.
That's a
And
lot.
you can look that up, guys. You can know how to look that up. And for most of the screeners, that positive predictive value is around 50%
Wow, that's bad.
for that primary care population. And that means that we've got an awful lot of people on our hands then who are scoring in the dementia range. And what happens is the GPs know this, and they kind of downplay this score in that case. So it's much better for us to do a targeted cognitive function test on someone who's at risk And then we don't downplay the score, we take it seriously because we know that they are likely, if they're scoring in the range and they've got risk factors, then it's much more likely that they do have something that needs working up and figuring out. So that's where I'm at about the cognitive function test.
That is
But an
fantastic.
awful lot of GPs will do them every health assessment from the age of 75. And you can have them every year, those health assessments.
Wow.
And the other thing to look at then is if they're scoring perfectly, to make sure that they're not going downhill
Yeah.
over say 5 years, and they might still be scoring in the normal range, but there's been a deterioration. And that's something that we don't tend to do, and we could do that as GPs and pick up some more dementia.
Wow, that's there's a lot to consider there. Definitely learned a few things there that I did not know. And Dimity, one of the other things I'm keen to hear from you about your work, what are some of the key things you've learned about dementia from the patients that you see?
I think it's a bit like some other diseases. So this is not particularly original, but if you've seen one person with dementia, you've seen one person with dementia. Because dementia presents in many, many different ways. And people with dementia have s different strengths, different abilities, and different ways in which that disease affects them. And so we need to work with them as individuals, as individual human beings who have a disease, and work out how that's affecting them now. And then in 6 months, it may be affecting them in a different way. So that's probably the first thing, that it's a very individual thing. And we can't just fit them into a box because they won't fit, because humans don't fit into boxes very well. That's one of the joys of general practice. So that's one thing. The next thing is, and I've got this prepared, guys, because you told me this question was going. The next thing is, don't underestimate the burden on the carer. And,
Yes.
try living with someone with dementia if you doubt me, even for 24 hours, and you'll know how difficult that is. As much as you love them, it's difficult and challenging. And it would be helpful to at least know what's going on, and certainly to get as many services as possible to try and alleviate. And the third message is start preventing dementia early. Get yourself onto the good diet, plenty of exercise, not too much alcohol, keeping your brain active. Start that. From as soon as you possibly can in life, but certainly from mid-age, because, and just think to yourself, it's not just a little bit of overweight and I'm tired and I can't exercise. Think to yourself, I'm going to prevent myself getting dementia, or at least slow it down if I go for a walk for half an hour a day. Even 2 bits of 15 minutes will work. They've done that trial in general practice.
Oh.
Or 3 10-minute lots will also work just as well as half an hour. So there were some researchers up in Queensland who did that trial. It's not for preventing dementia, that was for reducing blood pressure, but had the same effect as a half hour, a solid half hour a day for 6 days a week, or 3 10-minute lots for 6 days a week, had the same good effect on the blood pressure.
Oh,
So,
do you know blood pressure is a risk factor?
and it's a risk factor. So it would have an effect on preventing dementia as well. And the dementia prevention diets are delicious. Wonderful salads. I'm of course on that sort of diet, the Mediterranean diet. Plenty of olive oil. You don't have to, be boring. And plenty of fish and not too much red meat and so on. So you could, but there's so many recipes now. You can have a wonderful time with that diet. So
Yeah.
yeah. And you don't feel overloaded afterwards either. So, and there's always fresh fruit afterwards for dessert.
It's not
You
chocolate.
don't need to have chocolate cake every day. I'm not against it for a grand occasion, but
Yeah.
yeah.
They are amazing messages for the community. I just wanted to check in because you have spoken about multiple research projects throughout our chat today. And if there was any of your projects you wanted to highlight and any key messages from those pieces of research that you've done.
Well, the thing that occupies me at the moment the most is a series of research projects looking at the role of the nurse working with the GP. So we did one with a nurse practitioner who went out and visited people and was able to do the tests, more complicated than the screeners. And when they were referred by doctors who were worried about those patients. And she did a wonderful job at identifying dementia. And then we went back and had a chat with the GP and the practice nurse about this patient. And the patients had all consented to this and this diagnosis. This is what the nurse thought was going on. And then that nurse also knew all the services, the local services that were available. And the practice nurse would busily scribble down all the things that she could do to start mobilizing support for that person. So this was in outer urban areas out of Newcastle where it was very hard to get geriatricians to do a formal diagnosis. And it worked really well. And at the moment, I'm working with Dementia Training Australia on a nursing training for GP practice nurses on dementia. And because dementia affects your ability to self-manage everything, including wounds, including all your chronic diseases, the nurses have a big role in reminding people to get their vaccinations. People forget to get their vaccinations if they've got dementia. If you the nurses need to adapt what they say. If you're doing a wound dressing, don't give a complicated message. Give a simple message, get them back a bit more often. And so the nurses can do an awful lot. And I think it needs to be a real team effort across primary care. I'd spread that out to the other allied health professionals and the pharmacists too. But still working on those, but how to get that to work.
Gosh,
But I
that's
think that's what we
fantastic.
need to do. Yeah. Yeah.
That is, we started off chatting about the system, the health system, and
Yeah.
you're like researching what the health system could look
That's right.
like.
I'd love to see it looking like a net under people with dementia so that they don't fall, they get picked up by one person or another and put back into a supportive, safe environment.
What a beautiful message to end
That's
on.
so good.
Oh, wow. Well, I really hope that we see that health system come into fruition. I think we are going to be examining how we care for dementia, people with dementia, and their family members very closely over the next little while. So,
Gosh.
thank
Good.
you so much, Dimity, for joining us today. And we look forward to seeing all of your publications and all of the things coming out of these research projects.
And a pleasure. And for those of you who listeners who are concerned about dementia, just think that it's not the end of the world. There are things you can do to make yourself still enjoy life and make sure you make those choices.
Thank you so much, Dimity.
Okay.
Thank you,
Okay.
Dimity.
Bye
Thank
now.
you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Is This Dementia? An initiative of the Centre of Research Excellence in Enhanced Dementia Diagnosis, which is funded by the National Health and Medical Research Council in Australia. The podcast is produced and hosted by Sarah Carmody and myself, Darshini Ayton. Our music is composed and performed by Luke Champion. If you like our episodes, please follow us on your preferred podcast platforms. Thank you.